ready to start. And we are going to start with primary financial statements, and I give the floor to Aida.
Thank you, Hans. Well, a great starting point this board week. Good morning, everyone. So we have a barrage of papers for you today, but I just like to point out, despite the number of papers we have, you have actually substantively completed deliberations on this stage of the project already.
That's what I thought, yes. Until I saw all those papers.
This is just us trying to. So last month, as you all know, you made a decision that the next consultation, the first consultation document, will be exposure draft. Next month, what we are planning to do is seek permission to ballot. And what we've been doing in the meantime is really reviewing the board's tentative decisions made so far, how we articulate them, reviewing the feedback we have received so far, and in this process we identified a number of areas where we thought it could be useful to either clarify or slightly, let's say, tweak the proposals, considering articulation and the feedback we have received so far. So this means that none of the papers for this month or next month are what we would call mission critical for this project. They are smaller issues around the margin, but still are the issues that we think would be helpful to have more clarity on, in particular given that the consultation document will be exposure draft. And with that in mind, as I said, we've also been working on articulating board tentative decisions, and this new, the latest and the greatest articulation is in the cover note for this month board paper. So maybe just encourage you to, when you had a, if you have any specific thoughts or suggestions on what we have there, give us feedback on that either now or separately. And it's also a special month for PFS in another way. We have a couple of new team members, and they will have their first board presentations today. And I'd just like to remind you of the new PFS principle for these scenarios, which is that not only you are kind, but you also kindly agree with things they say. So with that, I think we're going to have a really great session. So we will tackle the papers in the order. So unless there are any questions or comments at this point, I'll hand over to Nick to tee up 21A for us.
Great, thank you. So 21A addresses questions regarding classification in the statement of financial performance for foreign exchange differences and gains and losses on derivatives. This is one of the issues that Aida mentioned that has been brought to our attention through outreach. Some preparers say that applying the board's definitions of the operating, investing, and financing sections in the statement of financial performance may be unclear when classifying gains or losses on foreign exchange or related to derivative instruments. So the paper is separated into three questions, which are interrelated, but we've addressed in three separate sections. First, we consider classification of foreign exchange differences without hedging. Secondly, we address classification of gains or losses on derivatives, and then we consider where non-derivatives might be used for risk management purposes. So before I get into the issues individually, I'd ask if there's any comments or questions on the approach so far.
Chuck.
Thank you. Well, I agree with the direction of what staff is seeking for, and I just really appreciate the effort you are making. Just let me make some suggestion to make it better. I was wondering if it is really good idea to separate the foreign exchange as a completely different things. The reason why I'm saying is there is often the case some company uses loan denominated in foreign currency interchangeably with the loan with your currency plus forex derivatives. So, for example, if you are a UK company, you have a big business in Europe, and then you constantly have a certain level of amount of account receivable. And then in order to hedge the forex risk, you may have a certain amount of loan payable denominated in euro. That is relatively common cases. Or you could either have forex derivatives. but they do it quite interchangeably. And if you make it a little bit too much rule-based, then if we follow the issue one, then those companies have to recognize Forex risk in the operating section, operating profit section, and then recognizes the other end in the financial section. So therefore, I rather prefer to have approach B in the section two for both Forex and non-derivatives. And then we can seek for some expedient if it is too much costly. That is what I could suggest at the moment.
Thank you, Tag, for, you know, just Jeff emphasizing really all three issues are quite related to each other. And, you know, we were discussing how to set out this paper, and we just thought that although same principles could extend, there are maybe differences in terms of cost of their application and how simple it will be to get there, which is why we thought it might be easier to discuss them separately. But, you know, please bear tax reminder that actually, you know, you can have economically the same event affecting things that are in the in each of these three topics.
Okay, Nick, please proceed.
Right, so notwithstanding tax point, on the first topic, so we think applying the board's proposals for the definitions to foreign exchange differences that arise in the statement of profit and loss is clear, because there will always be an identifiable asset or liability that gives rise to the foreign exchange difference, and the section that the income and expenses on those items are classified is already determined by the definitions set out by the board. However, we've heard that in some cases applying this may be costly. We intend to consider the extent of those costs in our outreach on the consultation document. So the first question for the board is, do you agree with the staff's recommendation to clarify that entities should classify exchange differences included in profit or loss applying IAS 21 in the same sections of the financial statement of financial performance as the income and expenses from the activities to which they relate in accordance with the board's definitions of the sections?
Nick.
Thank you. So I guess I do also have some overall comments, but and I think given that this issue has been raised by stakeholders and specifically preparers, it's important that we address it in the ED rather than be silent on it. I think there'd be danger of just not saying anything. And overall, I do support the staff proposals here. I think we have to be wary, though, that we, through consistency, that we are actually getting comparability that reflects the underlying economics. And I'm not sure that's true in all cases, following through on the proposals. When we looked at the feedback from the financial statements presentation project, there was only really one user comment on how Forex should be allocated into categories. And the proposals there, I understand, were very much around the cohesiveness concept and things go into the appropriate category. And really the comment there was that this is a very complex issue in terms of how it impacts companies. And actually cohesiveness independently wouldn't solve the issues. It was more about disclosing a bigger picture. Having said that, I would support the staff proposal on this question, indeed all the questions, because I just think we need to have something out there for our stakeholders to respond to, really, and being silent on this isn't appropriate.
Gary.
I also support the staff's recommendation. This one, actually, if the alternative is not good, which is to get very rules-based and start dissecting down the various subdivisions. So I think linking in the P&L, I mean, the FX FX gain or loss of the underlying assets liabilities that gave rise to it in translation, I think, is the only practical way to go. You can always get feedback to the contrary. Just one, in paragraph 14, we talk about cost benefit and might be difficult if it's centralized or done on a net basis. I don't want to diminish that, because I'm sure it's true in some places, but I don't know that I would overstate the cost of doing this either, because companies know where your assets and liabilities are, they know what subsidiaries they're in, and they generally should know why they've got them. So I won't, it's a big world, there's a lot of companies out there, but I would not overstate, you know, that cost because your question here implies it might be costly to track, which kind of tells you costly to know where they are and why they're there. And I don't think that's as big a deal as perhaps might be made. Again, recognize there's always exceptions, but I wouldn't overstate it. You guys might hear that same comment back to me more than once this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hans. I will not object to seek the views on classify exchange differences to different sections, but I do have sympathy with the analysis given and the concerns of the stakeholder raised in paragraph 14, with that the cost and especially the nature. Because I think the reason is that at the current accounting standards, actually, even with our proposed proposal with regard to performance statement, but the existing requirements for determination of exchange differences based on whether the line items in the statement of financial performance, they are monetary items or non-monetary items. For those non-monetary items, whether they are measured at the fair value or not fair value. Well, that means those line items are not, you know, was classified based on the operating activities or investment activities or financing activities. So that means if we introduce this notion, this requirement, those assets and liabilities in the statement of financial positions, and the companies, they have to reclassify those assets and liability items based on operating and investment, investing and financing. I think it really costs a lot for companies because they have to keep a separate IT system, develop a separate IT system, and track the changes arising from the foreign currency risk. So I think I have sympathy with those stakeholders raised concern about the cost. I think they are really cost. For some companies, maybe the cost is very high, because if they keep a transaction, and those multinational companies, they have a lot of different kind of foreign currency, not one currency, different kind of currencies, and they have to check all those foreign currency changes. I think, and that system will be totally different, because they have to develop new system and check those changes. So I think we should be aware that cost, and that cost may be not low, maybe very high. Secondly, with regard to nature, I think the exchange differences arising from the risk of foreign currency exchange rate. Sometimes if those risk and those exchange differences was included in the operating profit, I think this kind of risk actually different from operating risk, normal operating risk. So maybe, I'm not sure if those, you know, exchange differences including operating profit, users are really, you know, want, because sometimes if the countries, some countries, maybe the foreign, you know, the volatility of the foreign exchange rates very high, and it will absorb a lot of operating profit. So maybe I'm not sure whether users would like to this kind of operating profit, or they would like to that kind of exchange differences to be, you know, separate from normal operating activities profit. So I think that the nature are a little bit different. And as the staff analysis said that paragraph 14b said that the preparers always regard that, okay, those kind of risk out of control of the management, so maybe it's better to be presented separated from other operating activities. But anyway, I would like to this kind of analysis and the concerns to be fully sufficiently included in the basic conclusion, and try to seek the feedback from the stakeholders whether it's okay, especially the cost and the benefits the benefit from user side and also the cost from preparer side, whether you know the cost could the benefit could be justified by the cost. Once we require those different you know those exchange differences to be categorized to in different sections.
Anne?
Just wanted to respond to John Cho's comments. I'm just wondering if it's better to go this way and get the feedback, as you say, because if we go as proposed, it's a simpler way of trying to address the issue that we know people have views on. If we didn't do it this way, we'd get us into quite complicated trying to make rules or exceptions. So if we go this way, that we can then get the feedback and we can see how concerned people are about the costs.
Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay. So the second question is to do with the classification of gains or losses on derivatives. Given the nature of derivatives, it means they don't clearly fit our definitions of the sections defined by the board. The paper separately considers derivatives in formal hedging relationships designated in accordance with IFRS 9 or IAS 39, which we refer to as designative derivatives, and is the subject of question 2A on page 18, and those derivatives which are not, which we refer to as non-designated, and have asked a separate question in 2B. For designated derivatives, the staff think that the eligibility and documentation criteria for hedge accounting establish a clear relationship between the derivative and the item being hedged, which we have proposed as the basis for classifying the gains or losses on the designated derivatives, with an exception, as exists in IFRS 9, for cases where hedging of a net position would result in grossing up of the gains or losses. For the non-designated derivatives, staff has considered two approaches. Approach A is to classify the gains or losses on non-designated derivatives in a single location, which the paper proposes investing would best fit the definitions for this purpose. And approach B, to take a similar approach as for designated derivatives, classifying the gains or losses on those derivatives in the section affected by the risk the entity intends to manage, to the extent that it does not result in an undue cost or effort. The staff support approach B because we think this would better represent the risk management activity and promote greater comparability by providing similar classification for all derivatives, regardless of whether hedge accounting is applied or not. And we note that that would apply only to the classification and not to recognition or measurement. In all cases, the staff is proposing that when derivatives are not used for risk management purposes, the related gains or losses should be classified in income and expenses from investments. For the questions for the board, does the board agree with the staff's recommendation for designated derivatives as described in 2A? And maybe we ask the second one separately.
Mary.
This is one that's finally balanced for me. On balance, I tend more to the other view rather than staff recommendation in the sense that I think hedge accounting, especially if you're doing hedge accounting under IAS 39, hedge accounting under 39 doesn't talk about risk management activities the way IFRS 9 does. You know, that's really something we bring up more in the IFRS 9 hedge accounting world. Second, I think the implications of an entity saying, I'm going to go through the requirements for hedge accounting, including designation, documentation, testing, effectiveness, should have meaning that carries through to how you present the gains or losses. So my disagreement with the staff recommendation is the piece that says treat non-designated derivatives the same way as you treat designated derivatives. I would just make the break there. I think it might be a bit easier once people are doing, you know, once everyone is doing their hedge accounting in under IFRS 9, because that does have a discussion of the entity's risk management activities. But I think I still, even thinking to an all ahead to an all IFRS 9 world, would prefer to say it matters whether or not you have designated this item, this derivative, as a hedging instrument, and draw the line there the way you do in the next issue. As I said, I can see pros and cons, so it's a preference rather than an over my dead body kind of thing.
I'm going to break the rules and talk a little bit about B as well, just
given that Mary's started down that path. I'll follow her misbehaviour. I agree with the staff recommendations on both A and B. And for me, if I was explaining to somebody why I would go with this approach, I wouldn't so much lead with the lead-in in paragraph 40 that it reflects an entity's risk management activities, because I think we'll be subject to potential criticism that this is turning into a project with a different objective than what we started with. I think we should do what's in A and B, but more because I think it's similar to the first question in that we're putting things in the categories that most closely follow given the activities of the entity. So they're entering into derivatives that relate to the operating activities, relate to their investing, relate to their financing. It's not so much that it's risk management in the more formal sense, but it just sort of naturally fits with the three criteria that you've got. I like having the same approach for designated and non-designated derivatives, because hedge accounting is a choice and it's a difficult thing to do. Even in IFRS 9, where we've tried to align more closely with risk management, you need to be a relatively, I think, sophisticated preparer to be willing to jump through all the hoops to do hedge accounting. I've worked for more than one institution where you were not allowed to do hedge accounting because the risk of restatement and getting it wrong was so high that you just weren't allowed to do it. Even if you were risk managing, it was just a policy thing. And so I don't think there's any special badge of honour for me that you've gone through the hoops of doing hedge accounting. You could just as legitimately be risk managing using derivatives and not applying hedge accounting, because it's a choice under our literature. And I don't want that distinction between whether I've chosen to apply hedge accounting or not to really make this potentially big difference between designated and non-designated derivatives. So I'd go with your recommendation for that reason. Just one wording question. In B, where it says, in such cases an entity may classify, do we mean will classify? So if you haven't done, if you can't do it without undue cost or effort, you're not getting a choice of whether you put it into investing, it must then go in. So it should be will, I think.
Well, first of all, I would like to say that I welcome those recommendations altogether. I think they respond to a request that that we've received already on the subject. I agree with Nick that it was important that we would take position. I think on this particular issue, I sit in the middle between Mary and Sue. And I think I would want to agree with the staff recommendation. I would just suggest that as a minimum, there is some form of evidence that an explicit risk management policy is being applied, so that it's not totally 100% free option. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to the staff recommendation.
Gary.
Thank you. I agree with the staff's recommendation on B, and actually I strongly agree with the staff's recommendation. Sue articulated most of the rationale as to why. I think Sue pointed out hedge accounting is a choice. You can do it derivative by derivative, instrument by instrument, hedged risk by hedged risk, and so on. And sometimes it doesn't make all that much of a difference in terms of your business. You've managed the risk, whether or not it's accounted for as a hedge versus it's not accounted for as a hedge. And part of the reason why it might not be worth doing hedging, the documentation, the designation, the proof of the effectiveness test, day one and ongoing, is onerous. And let me give you an example, because I used to manage one of these processes. And it was a foreign exchange, that interest rate risk. Is you issue a purchase order, you might issue hundreds of them in a month to a foreign country, and each purchase order, in theory, could be individually designated, even though they're sort of cookie cutter in the sense they all look the same. But you might have a dozen items on the purchase order, so they're due in 90 days, but individually the items, some you delay, you know, for delivery or receipt, others come in early. So reasons like that, it's hard to demonstrate effectiveness. And it's hard to designate, well, what subset of the hedging instrument goes to which part of the purchase order. So, but if you're reasonably astute, it's easy to net those two off. You just mark them both to market, the foreign currency exposure, and the derivative, and you put them in the same line item in the P&L. It's every bit as much of risk management as hedging. You know, so maybe the real question is, why is it so hard to achieve hedge accounting treatment, which is a longstanding preparer complaint. So I see no practical reason why there should be a different answer. The burden, of course, will be on the preparer to demonstrate that these undesignated hedges actually serve a risk management purpose and what purpose that is. But just like anything else, they've got to document and demonstrate the rationale for anything, be it an asset or expense or liability, case may be. So I strongly support where the staff cannot be.
Darryl?
So I'm piling on a little bit here. I think I support where Sue is, I support where Gary is. I think it makes sense to treat these types of instruments held for these reasons in a consistent way. I also agree very strongly with Gary in that particularly when it comes, well, let me pick up on Sue's point first. Because this is an option in the standard, I think we shouldn't undermine that option by punishing people who've chosen not to go down the route of hedge accounting. But I think to Gary's point, I think it is particularly important that with FX-type instruments, you frequently can get the same outcome or very similar outcome to applying hedge accounting without having to go through that process. And so I think for that reason, for me, this is a particular category where I'd say people are less likely to use the full hedge accounting approach, even though their objectives are exactly the same as what they would be if they were applying a hedge accounting approach to it. I do think that Francois's point is a valid one, and I think the thing that probably would scare me slightly in this space is retrospective. So looking at the outcomes of the different numbers and saying, okay, where do I want it to go? And I think maybe this is Zhen Chao's point too, is that I think if we thinking that we're going to do a little bit more or find out a little bit more through the process of publishing the ED, we might want to just at least highlight the fact that there may need to be mechanisms around to make sure that you've not designated, if that's the right terminology here.
Predetermined.
And I think it is just that idea that what we clearly want to avoid is the circumstance in which I goal seek at the end to decide which area it goes into.
I see who supports the staff recommendations.
13.
Okay, final question.
Yes.
Sorry, is 13.1 same for the question A, or
yes,
as
A
with
and B?
So we have one against A as well. Okay.
Okay, so the... Yeah. Okay, so... Yep. So the final question addresses cases where risk management, where financial assets or liabilities that are not derivatives are used for risk management purposes. This happens in practice, and IFRS 9 and IAS 39 permit the designation of non-derivative financial assets or liabilities as hedging items. Again, the paper has considered instruments that are designated separately from those that are not. And as with designated derivatives, the staff think that designated non-derivatives, the eligibility and documentation requirements within IFRS 9 and IAS 39 allow the same clear link to be formed to serve a basis for classifying the gains and losses on the risks being managed. And we have therefore proposed a similar approach. On the non-designated, ideally we would have liked to have the same approach for gains and losses on instruments used for risk management, regardless of whether they're derivatives of not or not. And this would mean applying approach B, which I think Tack mentioned at the beginning, to non-designated non-derivatives. However, for non-designated non-derivatives, the staff have identified a number of challenges that we think would result in significant costs, and we don't think we have the evidence that to support the benefits would justify those costs. We have therefore recommended that the board require entities to classify non-derivative financial instruments in accordance with the definitions of the sections, regardless of whether or not they are used for risk management purposes. Again, we intend to evaluate the feedback on this proposal to further understand the costs involved and the potential benefits of the alternative approach. So the question to the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation for the designated and non-designated non-derivatives as described in question 3?
Chung Wu.
Thank you. I agree with the staff recommendation. However, just one thing to curious is kind of a description of a risk management, and the one transaction the talk raised before, a kind of a natural hedge. That generally the companies are doing some kind of a natural hedge by using the, some kind of a asset side and liability side. If that's the case, kind of that kind of a design of a natural hedge, that's included, be included in the risk management you are assuming in the paper, in this recommendation. Is that right?
So if you talk about the example Tuck mentioned, a point where entity would take a loan in foreign currency to manage the risk, for example, in sales in that currency, that is, I guess, what some would describe as natural hedge, or what we would describe as risk management. And, you know, what Nick acknowledges is our recommendation for the issue three doesn't afford this consistent treatment between this entity and an entity that, say, took out a derivative that would achieve the same effect. And the reasons for that is we don't think there shouldn't necessarily be a consistent approach, but we are just concerned of additional costs that such approach would impose on everyone in the chain.
Thank you. For this issue three, my first reaction was I disagree with this proposal, but having read the paper again and having a discussion with the staff, I have now a little bit mixed feeling. Have not yet decided. So I just want to raise a question. So I think in the case of derivative, then approach B works very well. I strongly agree with that. But when it comes to the non-derivatives, once you cannot designate, then you have to follow the definition of sections, no matter how you made a risk management. So that risk management cannot be reflected in the statement of financial statement. So that is why I disagree with it. But maybe the reason why staff do not go that way, do not go that approach B, is because in the case of non-derivative, there might be large proportion of what we call ineffective portion. So it may be quite difficult to distinguish how much is the for risk management and how much is for inherent to the underlying asset. So therefore, it may add complexity. So that is why you are proposing this issue C proposal. Is my understanding correct?
I think Dara was probably the best person to explain this, actually.
this may now, and you really have to be on the spot. I think for me, in thinking about this one, what makes it really difficult, and it comes back a little bit to where Mary was at the beginning when she raised her point, the difficulty with the assets and liabilities, the non-assets and non non-derivative assets and liabilities in this case, is that they are, for lack of a better term, dual-use assets and liabilities, even in the circumstance you've described. So I'm using them for something other than hedging purposes. I'm raising them as an initial because I need funding or because I need the assets for some reason, et cetera. And so what that's starting to do is to force the entity to think about the extent to which this is intended as a derivative or a non-derivative. This is extended as a hedging or as a primary purpose. How much am I intending it for? Now, I think one of the outcomes of thinking through that process is the ineffectiveness you're thinking about. If I need 100 million of funding, but I only need 70 million of hedging, is it 100 million of ineffective? Is it 30 million of ineffective hedging, or 70 million of effective hedging and 30 million of something else? And I think that's what makes this a lot more complex to think about. So I think the ineffectiveness comes into play in that question. It's not the only reason for me that I have a reservation against the approach. And, of course, you always have the ability, if you want to go through the process of designating if you believe that that's appropriate under the requirements or under the option in line.
I agree. Staff recommendation here. I think that one of the reasons why is for the reason that you've set out in 45B little 2, I can see there might be many more circumstances with non-derivatives where you may hold them for more than one reason. You know, I had some cash, I needed to invest it. I chose to do it in a foreign currency because that also gave me a hedge. But, you know, it was partly because I just needed to put cash somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the main objective? I think it's harder than derivatives, I think, would more typically be done with a more focused objective.
Mary.
On this question, I just wanted to comment about the plan to get feedback and outreach, which is a bit of me says we might hear from people who want to do this that don't worry about the cost, I can manage it. It's a worthwhile cost to incur. So I think we have to make sure that we also do outreach to users of financial statements in terms of asking the basic question of, if you have, let's say, the borrowing in a foreign currency, that's a natural hedge of some of the activities. Would you expect to find all of the remeasurement of the borrowing in one place or split, even if you don't get, just ask users as well, not just wait to hear what we hear back about our assessment of costs, because people who want to do it might be willing to say, don't worry about the cost, we can manage that. And the other thing, just a footnote, I wasn't against question 2A, but there was only one vote, so.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Daryl.
So Mary just reminded me of an additional question that I just wondered about. Obviously, the purpose of an ED is to do outreach and to hear people's views. So when we raise it specifically in the context of some of these sections, does that imply that this is going to be a separate question in the exposure draft, or that we're just going to have a separate channel of additional work to dig in a bit deeper?
Not necessarily a separate question. Not to say it's definitely not going to be, but I think with questions we have to take overall balance in mind and, what are the things from the project. But this is just an area for us as a staff to focus on the outreach to make sure we've asked. And this one might be one of those issues where we are more focused in terms of, people that we think might be most affected.
Then I think perhaps a little bit to Mary's point, because I think that the difficulty in having an area that we're targeting like this, if we are not highlighting it or making it clear to constituents that this is an area of particular interest for us, we may end up having feedback that is biased depending on who we ask the question of. But I think just finding a way to flag it up a little bit more in the basis from the question and the questions is going to help us get a more balanced feedback on the topic.
Yeah. So. Okay, thank you.
Okay, can I see who supports staff recommendation?
14.
No time to shine, Ken. It's Ken's first presentation. So he's going to introduce paper 21B.
Thank you, Ada. In agenda paper 21B, we discuss whether expenses related to the investment should be included in the investing section of the statement of financial performance. The current tentative definition of income and expenses from investments does not refer to expenses arising from activities related to investments. We think users of financial statements consider those expenses when they evaluate the return on an entity's investments. We therefore recommend that those expenses should be included in the investing section in order to give users better information about the performance of investments. In terms of the scope of expenses to be included in the investing section, we considered two terms used in recent IFRS, that are incremental expenses and directly related expenses. We recommend that only incremental expenses should be included, because this approach would help users better understand investing activities without requiring allocations that may be costly. The questions for the board are on page 6. Do board members agree with the staff recommendations to include expenses related to an investment in the investing section of the statement of financial performance and to define those expenses as incremental expenses?
Anne.
Yes, I do agree with the staff recommendation. I think we have to keep to the principles here. We've built this project up on our principles of defining investing, financing, and then investing. So I think we have to keep to those.
But I can understand, thinking about your work in paragraph 12, that you're now looking at these expenses and wondering what direction to give, and your idea being that it'll better be a reflection of performance in terms of investing if they are in the investing section and not in the operating section. So on balance, I do support putting them there, and I also support making them as incremental, not as direct. We have had discussions around the table about the direct costing and incremental costs in relation to the onerous contracts project, and I think we should avoid getting into all that detail here, so I'd go for incremental as well.
Tak. Thank you. In ISP's tradition, we have to be kind to the freshmen, but in Japanese tradition, we have to be very strict to the freshmen. Japanese staff, so I disagree with the staff. The reason why I'm disagreeing is this proposal could add some complexity to our model, and it could undermine our robustness of the model, because our model is clear that investment is mainly the stream of basically income-only stream. So if we try to creep some expenses into it, then that will mix up everything. And actually, it is quite difficult to distinguish what is incremental, what is not incremental. Actually, in the operating section, there is a general expenses. So if you have expenses about everything, it goes to the basically operating profit other than financing expenses. So our model is very clear. Financing is expenses relating to financing, and the investment section is extra outflow income. So other than that, those residual are operating section. And we are not positively defined what the operating section is all about. This is just the residual. So I do not feel uncomfortable with recognizing the cost expense relating to investment in the operating section.
Well, I hold a totally opposite view to that of TAC. And it's not only to be nice and pleasant to Kensuke. In fact, I'm very grateful that you've joined, because for me it was a long-awaited paper. So thank you for providing it. And I really think that, you know, you had in the former issue highlighted the fact that classification should aim at faithful representation. And I don't think we would have a faithful representation of the stream of income from investment if that stream of income was not netted of expenses. To be honest, in my view, the more relevant answer would be direct related costs. But I accept incremental and striking, in fact, the same balance as the staff does in the paper. So I really support.
Martin?
And I don't support staff recommendation because man have the same concerns as TAC, because man, where do we start and do we stop here? Because man, what is incremental to this kind of investment? Is it a kind of a portfolio manager who is also his only job is then doing maybe portfolio selections for investment, and then the staff cost is also in his investment section? When we're doing that, what are we doing with financing costs? Man, there are also incremental costs related to financing. And I think that makes the whole model then very, very complicated if we now doing this rules-based cost allocation, because we was addressed by somebody said, okay, what is about this fees here? But I think, and this is only one example, because I think from the principle-based, I think then we should have all incremental related costs to financing, to investing, then also allocating to that. And I think that will make the overall model too difficult and too complicated. And therefore, I agree with TAC, there should be an operating, and we should not make this distinction.
Cheryl.
We're going through a specific pattern here, so I agree with where staff have landed on this one. Possibly agree slightly more strongly than Francois on some of the background rationale. So I think what's important for me is I tend to think of investment activity as an incremental activity in itself. It's not something every company has to do. It's something over and above what the company is typically having to do as part of its operational process. I think it's misleading to reflect the costs of its investment activity in operating, because I think those are costs that would not have occurred but for the fact that it's chosen to chase this particular type of income. I think it also comes into, we've talked about fees and things, I think there's other specific things to bear in mind. A lot of investment activities will be at fair value, and that means all transaction costs are taken as costs immediately. So where would you take those costs in the circumstance? So I'm comfortable with the outcome, and I like the incremental answer, but I would go possibly, I'd put a slightly different focus on the incremental cost than what staff have. To my mind, given the objective here is to recognize what is an incremental activity, to split the costs on any other basis, I think would understate potentially the operating profits, because some of what you would have had to incur, even if you didn't have this activity, would then be taken out and put into the investment space. So I, over and above the fact that it's easier to identify, you've got two points that you've expressed, this, the one I've made, and the cost or the expense incurred in deriving these expenses. I think the second one is perhaps more important than the first one. To Martin's point on financing, this did bother me a little bit, but I think I'm more comfortable with the idea that all companies have to do financing, and that a lot of the expenses that are involved in financing activities are in any case captured in the EIR of the liability that you capture. So there's an element that you're picking it up through that process. But yeah, I support where you arrived at in this paper.
Well, I congratulate Ken on splitting the board down the middle. Maiden presentation. Very good work. Gary?
I also support the staff, and instinctively, this doesn't strike me as going to be the most commonplace of difficult issues that the pair is going to have to deal with. I think your example, and granted it's only an example, on page 7 has asset management fees as a good example, something discrete and something very directly related to it. But other than items such as that, I can't imagine, you know, people doing allocations of headcount or saying 4 people in this department are on it and 6 people there are on it. I just don't see that happening. I see it being limited, discrete, very visible type activities being charged into here. And I don't see anything else being moved in the main in there. So I support the staff's recommendation. But someplace I think we as an organization, doesn't have to be in this document, but we've got a different conclusion about cost for the IAS 37 work that we're doing, where it's direct, incremental and direct related. Here we're only using incremental. Someplace, somewhere, someone's going to ask us, similar projects at the same period of time, you come up with slightly different answers. I just think we need some place to get the word out there as to why the distinctions were different. I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing it in the ED for this project, but someplace I think organizationally we should.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, yes. I think the clarification on expenses related to investment, whether it should be included in the investing section, is necessary. So I generally support the staff's proposal. I think the easier way, as Tag mentioned also, whether those expenses should be included in investment section or operating section, I think the main reason is how, because we have no definition on the expenses related to an investment. So it could be very broad, it could be very narrow. So in this case, I support the incremental expenses, but as Gary mentioned, whether we should using what kind of word, how to define that those expenses is very important. Mm-hmm. But I do look at what kind of expenses we are talking about that. Paragraph 10, we said that we give some examples, such as asset management fees, maintenance fees for investment properties. I think those are very clear, but the meaning of the assets
management fee, people will have different understanding whether it's the money, this is the fee I paid for, you know, the, other companies help me to manage the assets, or whether the fee I, you know, paid, but I manage the assets by myself. So I think this kind of thing should be clarified. Secondly, another example we're giving is employee benefit expenses related to investing. So it could be very broad or it could be narrow. So whether this kind of labor cost, is those labor cost relevant to those guys who doing investment, you know, management by in your company, or it's very below? So I think this kind of, what's the expenses related to investment, it could be clarified further. I think from my point of view, it should be very narrow, but it's possible to clarify further, even what's the meaning of the incremental expenses relevant to the investment. Then I think it's very helpful especially for preparers, when they determine what kind of expenses should be included in investing section, will be very, very helpful for them. So generally, I agree. I think we do need to clarify the expenses related to an investment, whether they should be included in the operating section or should be included in the investing section, based on the conclusion we made. The first question, I think we do, if those expenses related to an investment, I think those expenses should be included in the investment section.
Mary?
I feel like Cassandra, because I'm going to warn, I agree with those who do not support the staff recommendation, particularly Martin's observations about it. And the reason I feel like Cassandra is I'm saying, I read this and I think, having said we're not doing the FSP project, I feel like this is kind of heading back to the FSP project. And to Anne's point about we have to be consistent with our principle, to me our principle is all of our operating activities, all of are in operating. And if investing is a main business activity, then it gets moved up to operating, and therefore the expenses related to, the asset management fees, et cetera, would be presented in the same place. If it's not a main business activity, I don't want to open the door to starting allocation, even if it's on a direct basis, of certain expenses incurred in the activities of the business as a whole, to the different subsections. I think either it's a significant enough activity to be a main business activity and you fall into moving it up, or it's not, in which case, and there's, this paper really highlights a critical word in the previous decisions, which is income or expense from investing. And that word from means just from the investments, as opposed to and their associated costs. To me, and I think emphasizing what from means, but I think once we open the door here, even on an incremental basis, we're starting to raise questions about what else should you allocate. So for that reason, I don't agree with Anne's point about it's just explaining a consistent application of the principle, because I think there's a higher principle about how we're approaching this, and it's not starting to slice and dice income and expense. Unless it specifically meets the definitions of those other sections. So I do not support the staff recommendation, and I hope I do that in a friendly but strict way.
There's good arguments on both sides. You'd convince me when I read the paper, so I think I'll stay with being convinced by your arguments in here. But the thing that strikes me a little bit, and it's been brought out in some of the discussion here, is I think we need to be careful. This is probably a good case for how far we should go with the ideas we've got, sort of following on from Mary's point, because we seem to, with this series of papers, which raise, I think, a whole load of legitimate questions, but it's all about how far do we go? How nitpicky do we start to be in terms of how precise the allocation should be between the sections? And even though I'm usually a board member who says, you know, don't talk specifically about materiality because it always matters, I think we need to be very careful to remember that this is presentation and, you know, materiality will matter a lot here, because I think otherwise people listening to this are going to start thinking that every time they do a journal entry, they're going to have to be thinking which section of the income statement is this going to have to turn up in. And we're only, at the end of the day, I hope, talking about where we're putting things in terms of sections if they're material. And if you've got investing activities, which by definition sort of aren't core, even though we don't use that term, how many material investing expenses should we be expecting people really to be picking out? So I think we need to be a little bit careful that this either doesn't inadvertently turn into the old project or imply that suddenly we're becoming very nitpicky, because surely at the end of the day we're talking about things that are so important they need to be presented in a particular place on the face of the income statement that it matters enough for the allocation. And if we're starting to talk about expenses on investing, if it matters, then I sort of agree with your logic, but we shouldn't sort of over-egg the fact that it's going to be an everyday discussion.
And that's a great reminder, really, that, you know, on a bigger scale of things on the project, this is really not, you know, going to be the biggest issue. But, I mean, I know we wrote the paper, but to me, the way Daryl articulated, I think, is probably the most useful way to explain it. And rather than saying we are here to separate expenses, really the whole purpose of this is to have a faithful representation of operating profit subtotal. And to us, I mean, this is really the key thing of the project. Most companies out there today have operating profit subtotal. You know, just recently we have done review of our sample, or Frank's sample. We have found at least 9 different ways in which this operating profit has been defined today. And the whole idea is to have a faithful representation of something meaningful. And these expenses are just an example when something is really significant and that wouldn't be incurred if it wasn't for this activity that is not operating. Then it really contributes faithful representation of operating profit, not having it there. But, you know, without, as you say, going into the nitpicking of the details, you know, what is in, what is out.
You've provoked further questions, comments, Françoise?
Yeah, I wanted to add that I think going to incremental is in a way ring fencing what's taken, I mean, presented there. I would be supportive that the arguments that Daryl has indicated be brought to the basis for conclusions, including what Daryl said about financing. So it shows that this is one case where that is done and it's not all over the place.
Although one of the meanings of the word incremental is little. And that would run completely counter to what Sue just said. So be aware of the language that you use. Jen Chow.
Thank you. Just one point following Mary's comments. I think when we introduce this notion, I think even we introduce some examples to illustrate what's the meaning of the expenses related to an investment, still should based on the general principles how to classify those operating activities, operating, investing, and financing, especially what's the main business of those companies to have. Suppose, for example, we give an example called that maintenance fees for investment properties, and they say that that fee should be included in the investing section. If the investment property company and its company's main business is holding that investment property to earn rentals and asset appreciation. So that means those fees, from my understanding, should go to the operating section, not the investing section.
Yeah.
So I think this kind of thing should make it very clear and still based on the principles and not simply go to the those examples. But we do need, because we have no definition here, so we should be very careful to illustrate what's the meaning of the expenses related to an investment. Yeah. Also, same issue as the assets management fee also have similar issues there. Yeah.
Martin, and then we vote.
Yeah, mine, I think it's not a big deal if we're doing that. But I think from the principle, I think we started the discussion when we run the project, where income and expenses from this kind of investment will fall. Where I think income and expenses from funding, from financial instruments in the funding area, now we're going further, is related expenses to that. It would indicate for me we're going more into this business. And I think that is a kind of, I think if we're doing that, people will asking all these questions. And therefore, I think we should not do it. I think we should be silent on that and done what we have done, because it is income and expense from this kind of investments, income and expenses from this funding instruments, but not related costs to that. It is a more principal thing, which I think, but if we only doing this kind of asset management fees, maybe is not a big deal and maybe it's minor, but I think it is gives the wrong direction.
Okay, who can vote in favor of the staff's recommendation?
Nine.
Okay.
So I think we are ahead of our internal team allocation, so we're going to squeeze in Jen and have another paper. Or maybe all of them, let's see. So Jen, again, another first board presentation.
See how successful you are in splitting the board.
21C considered whether to provide guidance on how to determine tax effect of amended performance measure adjustments. The staff think we need to provide guidance to avoid the stakeholder incurring costs in determining what guidance to apply. We consider two approaches. Approach A refers to guidance in IAS 12, including practical expedient for allocation in exceptional circumstances. And approach B would specify that income tax effect of NPM adjustments should be determined based on a reasonable pro rata allocation of the current and deferred tax of the entity in the tax jurisdiction concerned, or other method that achieves a more appropriate allocation in the circumstances. Compared with the first approach, the staff think the second one is simpler and less costly to apply and would meet the information needs of users. Therefore, the staff recommend approach B. It brings to our first question to the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation of approach B.
So I do agree with the staff recommendation. I feel this is an area where we don't want to be getting into the weeds and nitpicking. And so I'm very happy with the overall approach. Yeah.
Tom, also happy? Are you also happy, like Nick?
Mostly. I just have a kind of a question. I just want to be clear on something as we go through this. In the first part of question one, it says, does the board agree with the staff recommendation to specify all the way down to the comma? It seems to me that applies more to the non-exclusions. Because in paragraph 15, you make arguments that for exclusions, you should be able to do some pretty precise stuff. And it seems to me the exclusions are the or other method that achieves. So that's my first question. Am I reading this right?
At the risk of getting into it, Nick and Sue, forgive me, I'll try to not do this. I mean, we have tried to go down this route and assess, you know, and just for everyone's clarity, exclusions, you know, the NPM adjustments where you simply take out IFRS recognized expense or income, whereas what we call tailor-made accounting policy where you change the accounting basis. So we try to assess it either two ways, but I think, Tom, it actually very much depends because, remember, our recommendation reflects practical expedient that is there for OCI and items that are recognized in equity today, and those, I think, are more equivalent to exclusions than TAPs, but it was still needed because just the way sometimes tax is done on aggregated basis, not on individual transactions basis, so it might be just difficult to, even though straightforward, you know, this adjustment, you know, my tax rate is so-so because of the way tax works, you might still need to do an allocation rather than straight up.
Okay, so, I guess the reason it concerned me a bit was in your evidence, you said 85% are exclusions. and it seemed you could do a more precise allocation for the 85%. And the way this reads, it uses the cover for the 100% essentially as the lead, as, and that's, I think that's okay. I just wondered whether you were comfortable, because it seemed to me that you could have worked some of the where you can do this, should you be doing what you say in paragraph 15, which is a nice paragraph, but that's not going to appear. And so that was just my kind of, when I read it, I don't disagree, but I'm a bit concerned it could be better.
We deliberately took wording directly from what's in IS-12 at the moment rather than coming up with our own wording for this. And so rather than designing something that might be more specific to what we were looking at, we thought it was beneficial to people to have wording that they're familiar with and a concept that they're familiar with. So that's why you're seeing that drafting.
Okay.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. I just followed Nick's point. I think I also fully agree with the staff's proposal. I think the reason, because currently we introduced some requirements, a discipline on NPM, but NPM is still NPM. They are not IFRS-defined measures. So I think it's not necessary to require the company to calculate the income tax effect of those NPM adjustments precisely. So especially for those companies operating in different tax jurisdictions, if they are required to precisely to calculate those numbers, it will cost too much. So I agree with the staff's proposal.
Gary?
Thank you. I absolutely agree we should give guidance on the subject. I agree the companies should disclose how they did it. And the problem is I support approach A, not approach B. And for a number of reasons, I think first of all, MPMs tend to be recurring items, not in all cases, but frequently. Therefore, you sort of know where the expense is arising and where it's going to be consumed internally. I think it, when you put on paragraph 25 of the paper, you said basically it says approach A could work for most MPMs, but it can be complex. Well, taxes are complex. So if you go to your question one, and it says, the fourth line says that basically should be allocated in the tax jurisdiction concerned. Well, that in itself is not always as straightforward as you'd like to think it is. It might, when you have consolidated returns and, you know, lower subsidiary returns affect higher level subsidiaries' returns, and ultimately gets to the one way or the other, whether it's foreign tax credits or foreign tax payments or whatever made, affects the ultimate parent. So I think, if it's going to say the tax jurisdiction concern, I think we should clarify and says the tax jurisdiction where the initial charge was recognized, as opposed to, because ultimately it probably affects the entire group level set of returns to the extent it rolls up in various indirect ways in that. And I think when it says, and I would agree if we're going to go this, a reasonable pro rata allocation works. But then gets the question, what is a more appropriate allocation of circumstances? I mean, the obvious one might be the MPM is non-deductible and everything else is, so that'd be pretty easy. But I don't think it's quite that easy at all times, because more appropriate is, to some extent, is the eyes of the beholder in it. So I think approach A sort of answers or provides an established wherewithal of how to do it. So it would, again, support giving guidance, support disclosing how we do it. I would just prefer approach I.
Martin.
A little bit similar to Gary, because man, I also don't know what a more appropriate allocation would be, and because maybe some companies doing an exact calculation of their tax, because maybe they have an after-tax measure, and then you have to decide, okay, what is more appropriate? Is that more appropriate, yes or no, or to another? So I agree we should do that and give guidance how to make it easier, but I think we should say or other methods that also is appropriate allocation in the circumstances. But what is more, I don't know. So I agree we should also disclose, but I don't think we should say more appropriate.
Mary?
I'm just thinking about Martin's question about, you know, what is more appropriate. It reminds me of something that we're trying to be more disciplined about in the disclosure objectives, which is to say, this is the reason we're doing something, and to go back at the beginning of whatever comment we make about taxes, in terms of saying, here's the reason for requiring, you know, the separate information about the non-controlling interest in the taxes. It's, you know, in order to allow a user to decide what adjustments would have to be made, and therefore it's important to understand whether this item has a proportionate or disproportionate, you know, tax aspect. And I think if we think about trying to say something like that, it might help a little with Martin's concern about how do I know what's more appropriate. It isn't to do a precise tax accounting. It's to remind people what the objective is of specifying the tax amount associated with each adjustment.
I think we're taking those words based on what the staff has written in paragraph 20, which means we're actually taking words out of paragraph 63 of 12. And by doing that, we are working on an established piece of literature and therefore trying to avoid more questions. If we take that paragraph and then change words, people are going to say, oh, you must mean something different by changing words. So I can see why we're taking those words and trying to work with them at this stage.
Daryl.
So I kind of understand where everybody's coming from in that when I read this, I was thinking that what we were trying to achieve is to make life easier for everybody. And I think the concern that's been sort of raised a little bit is that the words as they're written may in fact be making things harder for people, if I understand Martin, your point and Gary's point. Do we have any view on how this paragraph is interpreted right now in IS 12, how it's actually being used on an ongoing basis? Because to say it's in IS 12, I think it's pretty clear this is intended as relief from doing it the hard way. That or other method seems to imply that perhaps you actually have to do work to prove another method is not more appropriate.
We have sought to obtain this evidence. However, paragraph 63 currently applies only in exceptional circumstances. So this is the wording that is there in IS 12. And we have found evidence of some guidance, haven't we, Jen, in, you know, around this. But it was all quite simple and not really addressing the questions you're raising. So I don't know whether this means it's rarely used in practice or whether it just means people are not so bothered about the method. I can't really say.
I mean, it does feel, and I don't want to change where we are, I think, because I think we're in but it does feel like almost what we're thinking is an implicit undue cost or effort that's included in how far you have to look for those other items. But I think this almost needs to be expressed in the context that it's intended as a relief, and therefore the expectation is not that you're going to go and dig for things all over the place.
Martin.
And to Anne's point, I understand that it comes from, as we say, in 20, but my point was a little bit different, because if a company has an exact calculation of the tax related to these items, if you make that tax, they have to overcome and say, okay, this exact calculation of tax is more appropriate than this allocation method. And I think that is not what we intend to do. We want to give a relief. If you don't have the exact number, then you should maybe using that. That is my understanding.
So
companies maybe have a good allocation of that, and then I think we should give them, okay, they should use that and disclosing that. But it should not then have a hurdle saying, okay, but is my method, which I think is appropriate, more appropriate than what we're giving here? Or is my exact calculation, is that more appropriate than, okay, this thing? That is my point. But in practice, an auditor will ask him, please proof that is more appropriate.
We're in danger of starting to interpret IS 12 on the fly here, but I think the reality is the way I had thought of this working is that if I did have the actual calculation, that would always be more appropriate, but that I wasn't forced to go and look for the actual calculation. And it feels to me more like we need to at least contextualize that this is intended to make it easier, but not to oblige you to do something that you know is wrong and you have evidence to prove is wrong. So it is the context that's going to be really important.
Jungwoo.
Thank you. May I ask Gary, approach A is a little difficult in the case of MPMs are based on tailor-made accounting policies. So if their NPMs are just based on some kind of non-IFRS, for example, measures, then you still prefer approach A than B?
Yeah, I do, because I think approach B, and I'll accept what Nick and some of the user feedback says, we don't need precision, roughly right, you know, it'll be good enough or directionally correct or something like that. But, you know, the history around, you know, the time you and I have all been here, I mean, usually the first going position any new issue is there's diversity in practice. Without some degree of precision, I think that we're going to be hearing those words again, you know, down the line. I also think tax allocations for companies that have got reasonably adept tax departments, which anybody operating in multiple tax jurisdiction probably does, tax allocation or tax effects of transactions, that's a skill. They know how to do these things. I mean, I'm not saying there's only one way to do it. Personally, if I was writing it, I would say the tax effect should be the with and without effect of the group's consolidated tax provision, as if this MPM did not exist. That's how I would articulate it. That goes back more to the days when tax provision accounting was more tied to percent of pre-tax income as opposed to the balance sheet approach we're at today. But, I mean, an MPM is viewed as a very important measure, important enough that management flags it out as something to be ignored, considered, analyzed out, or whatever else. Well, the pre-tax number in it is probably pretty precise. I don't know why the tax effect number should be any less precise.
Sue? Just to respond to one thing which I think Martin raised. I presume we're not saying you have to do some sort of accounting allocation. If you know the actual effect, you'd use that, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's our assumption, that you would, if you know the actual effect, you'd use it, because that's bound to be a more appropriate appropriate amount than an allocation in those cases.
Surely we could make that clear.
Well, besides, those words don't say that.
We could make that clear in the words, right? Because I think that's what some people are worried about, that it's sort of forcing you to do an allocation.
With this clarification, who can support a staff recommendation?
12.
We think a disclosure of the method used to determine the tax effect would provide useful information with little extra effort for preparer. So the second question is, do you agree with staff recommendation with respect to the disclosure requirement?
Yeah. 13.
You guys are so quick. I can follow. Okay. Let's take a break till 1:30.
On a roll, carry it.